Our present series is to be concerned with a study of pressure as we experience it in daily living and a search for remedy with particular reference to the development of Zen philosophy in China and Japan. One of the interesting symbolisms of Zen is the construction and arrangement of the principal temples of this sect. The Zen sanctuary is usually a comparatively simple structure. Very little ornamentation, very few religious symbols. The entire temple is oriented in terms of its meditation gardens. These may be one or several. They will be hedged or wall enclosures, each a world to itself, each a retreat against confusion, and each so carefully and wonderfully contrived as to give the impression that it is merely nature reaffirming itself, restating its own influence in the life of the individual. The therapy of the Zen garden lies in its contribution to man's acceptance of life itself. That man shall change his point of view from a desperate struggle to a quiet realization or recognition of essential value. The Zen garden, therefore, retires from human involvement. Man experiences the garden only as an observer. He finds between himself and this sanctuary no interference, no involvement in the fashion of man-made things. The garden itself is so beautifully put together that there is no visible indication of human handiwork. It is simply nature recognized as something of extraordinary beauty. It is as though we looked out through a window to a magnificent scene created by a power infinitely greater than ourselves. This type of garden is very well known not only to the mystics of Asia, but to persons in every walk of life. You may find children making a pilgrimage to such gardens after school, not because they are told to, but because it represents an interlude which they have experienced as important to themselves. Young people, older persons, parents, grandparents, simply come and sit for a little while in this garden for purposes of reorientation in an effort to discover relationship with life, a relationship which is lost because of the illusion and confusion resulting from living forever in a man-made environment. Man-made things move in upon us until we almost come to believe that we live in a man-made universe. And if this peculiar delusion actually controls us, suddenly the meaning of life is destroyed. Life has to have sureties, values, facts, truths that are larger than the contrivances of men. If these larger facts are not available to us as vast forms and patterns of strength, we suddenly find ourselves extremely weak. We have no support, no strength, no reserve against pressure. So the Zen garden represents an area that is without pressure. something to be experienced and to be accepted without even creedal considerations. You do not have to believe anything in order to enjoy the garden. All you need to experience is the need for that garden. Today in our Western way of life, we are all experiencing need. Need for some type of internal quietude. Unfortunately, we do not all have Zen gardens available to us. Nor would we probably choose to attend them even if they did exist. We have a different attitude on these matters. Yet regardless of our attitudes, we are the victims of the one common difficulty which is experienced today entirely over the surface of the earth, and that is pressure. So for the next few Wednesday evenings, we want to study pressure as we experience it in daily life. And we want to see whether there are some defenses that we can use in an effort to restore our own securities. Our first line of defense against pressure, of course, is our equivalent to the Zen garden. Where in our lives is there an area without pressure? What is there in our pattern of things which constitutes at least a temporary release from pressure? Now in the West we have always assumed that the change is the rest, that the individual engaged in certain activities finds peace or relaxation merely from shifting to another activity. Here in the West we are afraid of the horrible possibility of not doing anything. We feel that we cannot rest in a state of inertia. We say that we are too active-minded, that we are too positive, that we are too drama-conscious to permit ourselves to simply fold our hands and do nothing, even for a moment. So to us, release is merely a transference of a point of interest from one pattern of excitement to another. We are afraid of this letting down circumstance. We are afraid of simply resting. In fact, we have almost no experience in resting unless we are one of that small group of extremely lazy persons who have very little respect in our society. We are either lazy in the negative sense or we are frightfully occupied. We do not recognize or understand this release from action, this release into recuperation. Actually, if we were all as busy as we think we should be for the 24 hours of the day, none of us would live very long. So we do have one escape from all of this, the one inaction that we know, and that is sleep. Sleep is a condition which, as far as the busy man is concerned, is nature's complete waste of time. Many persons resent sleep because it interferes with activity. They grudge themselves, even rest. But when fatigue comes upon them, they have no choice. Sleep, therefore, represents, in a sense, nature's pattern of correction. It is the individual achieving a complete letdown by the loss of consciousness. Having ceased to exist as a person, he finds himself unconscious but free of tension. That is, of course, unless he is carrying tension into sleep. This may happen, but still, in the large, sleep is release. Now, in this state of release, why is man released? Is it simply that it is his loss of self-awareness Probably this is the dominant factor. Having ceased to become to be aware of self, of the tremendous pressures of self-purpose, the individual suddenly relaxes. Zen might define it in this way, that the individual can never relax until he loses the compulsion of his own selfness. As long as he says to himself, this I must do, this I cannot escape from, this I cannot postpone, this must be achieved, or I am a failure, or I am miserable, I am poor, I am decrepit, unless I do this. While these attitudes remain, the person is under tremendous tension. So in the Zen philosophy, meditation becomes a kind of sleep. Yet it is not a sleep of unconsciousness. It is a sleep of directed adjustment with life. We can follow nature's way and depend upon complete loss of consciousness for this desperately needed letdown. Or we can develop an art in this, as Eastern mysticism has done. An art which perfects nature, anticipates its needs, and furthermore makes man a living, contributing force to his own relaxation. Instead of having his consciousness blocked by natural processes over which he has no control, he recognizes his own need, becomes in a sense the master of his own destiny, and coming to know that relaxation is important, he cultivates it. And by cultivating it, he has it when he needs it. In the Zen garden relaxation concept, therefore, the person is simply recharging the battery of life. He is recharging it, first of all, by no longer calling upon it beyond its natural capacity. One way of conserving energy is to hold on to what you have. Man cannot actually positively create energy, but he can administer the use of it. He can guard himself against the waste of it. He can use his energy allotments as wisely and as skillfully as his intelligence permits. To do this, he must be conscious of this allotment. He must become aware that his energy is one of his responsibilities. He must administer it as he administers everything else in the life he lives. So realizing that he must conserve, he wishes to find the best possible way of preserving and conserving his energy allotments. When his body is hungry, he seeks food. When his body needs rest, he seeks sleep. His body is cold, he either finds warmth or increases his clothing. If his body is too warm, he does the reverse. He tries to adapt himself to the needs of this compound structure which he calls his body. Man's contact with life around him is largely dependent upon the processes of the nervous system. Therefore, the nervous energies must be conserved. They must be properly regulated. The mysterious group of energizers, which control and direct the flow of nervous energy and nervous resource, must be understood and their processes guarded. Failure to take all of these into consideration means the gradual loss of energy supply, the waste of it, the sacrifice of it for purposes or ends that are neither useful nor essentially necessary. Tension not only demands more energy, but it wastes more energy. The tense person is using too much vital resource too rapidly. In nature, man is probably about the only creature that is consistently tense. Animals develop moments of tension, but they are not constantly tense because the animal lacks ambition. The animal does not have the long-range strategies which affect man. Animal instincts arise quickly. The animal obeys them. When instinct arises in man, it is almost inevitably met with conflict. The individual, under every instinct and impulse, finds himself at conflict with himself. As a result of constant conflict, there is further depletion of energy. Man, being a creature capable of tremendous intensities, it does not follow that his organism and structure is capable of maintaining a continuous pressure pattern. Man is actually a far more fragile creature than he realizes. It seems sometimes as though he is almost immortal, that his body and personality can stand intense stress over vast periods of time. At another moment, these life resources disappear so quickly and with so little apparent cause for disappearance that we wonder how fragile this personality really is. But one thing is certain, it cannot stand the pressures which Western man is imposing upon it. It can stand them for a little while, but not indefinitely. And every individual has to find a way to reduce the pressure content in his own nature. So we have to try to figure out how he can do this and still retain his place in society and meet the challenge of the conditions that arise around him. One thing that creates pressure in man is responsibility. And responsibility nearly always results from the person taking on various patterns of duties which he must protect, must fulfill, must guard with his resources over a long period of time. Thus, one of the reasons for pressures is commitments. These commitments represent responsibilities voluntarily or sometimes involuntarily assumed, but nevertheless present. And in the effort to meet these responsibilities, the person very often exceeds his own capacities. With life as it is at the present time, the planning for the future of a pattern of responsibility is extremely difficult. Duties which we may assume today as quite possible and reasonable may prove an extraordinary and incredible burden 5 years from now. Things that can be done today with a minimum of effort may be impossible of accomplishment at some future date. Thus, the assuming of long-range responsibilities requires a great deal of thoughtfulness. And responsibilities demand a certain kind of person. All persons are not suited to these responsibilities. Some can carry them with wonderful dignity. Others cannot carry them. And our tendency today is to assume that the person who cannot is simply weak, is simply not standing up and doing what he should do. We measure all persons by the few who seem to achieve their ends, and all others are measured in terms of being lazy or witless or lacking in character or integrity or resource, character, or principle. The truth of the matter is, we do not all have the same resources with which to carry the burdens of life. Resources depend upon so many things. And each person, in estimating his own pattern in life, should at some time survey his resources to find out how much of a load he can really carry. If he has a very small probability in these areas, he must live within it. Or else, he must find ways of increasing his abilities. To drift along on the assumption that whatever we are endowed with, this is our allotment, we can do nothing more to it, other people must accept us as we are, such attitudes, usually almost total indifference to the matter, will have very little constructive effect upon the degree of responsibility or pressure that we can naturally assume. There are in this world many persons, for example, who by natural tendency, natural inclination, are suitable to parents, suitable to parenthood. There are others who are not and will not be so suitable. They are incapable of the maturity of judgment necessary to maintain a successful home. When these persons attempt to do so, they overtax their allotment of integrated integrities. These people, therefore, fall apart. They cannot help it. And it is wrong to assume that this collapse is due to extraordinary weakness. It is not. It is rather due to the lack of organization or integration of resources. A person simply is not able to carry the responsibility. A child growing up in a badly adjusted home is not going to have capacities to maintain a home of his own to the same degree that a child brought up in a well-integrated home will have these capacities. The individual of educational limitation, finding it ever more difficult to make a living at all, will not have the same ease in maintaining a household that will be experienced by the person who has an adequate education and is therefore capable of maintaining himself in an executive position. The person by nature physically healthy has a better chance of carrying responsibilities than one of delicate constitution. A person with a healthy, robust nervous system is more likely to remain optimistic, to face the situations of life with a good hope, than one who is naturally hypersensitive or shows strong neurotic tendencies. Thus, the personality, its equipment, its development, the judgment and strength by which action and thought are guided, these things determine the degree of pressure which we are going to suffer. The person who is adequate to his situations functions with less pressure. The individual who is struggling desperately to maintain a situation which may escape from him at any moment because of lack of his own resources, this person is under tremendous, terrifying pressure. Normally, man's nervous system is so constituted that it places a certain natural boundary upon pressure reflexes. The person who has only a certain degree of acceptances, who can only stand a certain amount of pressure, is usually but protected by nature. For if pressure far beyond this degree develops, the person is simply unaware of it. That which cannot be experienced within the common life of the individual, he may not react to at all. And if he does not react to it, no pressure results from it. But today, the levels of life which once protected the person have been badly broken up and confused. Up to the beginning, even the first decades of the present century, life was very largely stratified. Abilities caused individuals to belong to groups. In these groups, they were accepted because their abilities were about the same as the abilities of other members of the same group. Those with moderate attainments expected to live moderately. Those who had limited earning capacity did not expect to live luxuriously. The code of life, the status of living, the cost of living, these conspire together to help the person to live within a pattern of abilities. It is a pattern of abilities meant that he must maintain an establishment on a limited budget. I remember very well when a person could rent a good 5-room house on a good-sized lot without buildings for $15 a month. People lived in them and were quite happy about the whole thing. Today, even the same piece of property would rent from 8 or 10 times that amount. In those days, people worked hard, expected to. Therefore, the work being according to an expectancy did not produce tension, it produced fatigue. Today, we do not work to the full physical resources which we possess, but we are poorly adjusted for the most part in the things we are doing. Therefore, our endeavors produce tension and not fatigue. The average person is not physically tired, he is nervously exhausted. And discovers to his amazement that nervous fatigue is the most desperate kind. Trying to estimate some of the patterns then, in a practical way, we come finally to the realization that society today, whether it be the great society, or the great socialized unit that some are dreaming of, or the great communized state that most are afraid of, regardless of what this pattern may be, the truth remains that society is not protecting the individual and has no intentions of protecting the individual. Society will provide the individual with certain situations, certain conditions. Society can develop a sufficiently benign attitude so that it will prevent the individual from starving to death. It may bring to him socialized medicine. It may make more and more secure the bare necessities of his existence and even provide him with some luxuries. But society is not concerned essentially with the individual. It is concerned with a series of sociological platitudes to which the individual is variously related. Society is not interested in the individual for one definite reason, that no society as we know it today is geared to the potential of the normal person. No society has as its final end and objective that the individual shall be protected against the pressures which will sicken or destroy him. Society today wishes to continue to produce these pressureful situations and then provide medicine at lower rates for those who are destroyed by the pressure. Society continues to make us sick and then gives us socialized medicine as a panacea. There is no intention to change the tempos which we regard as necessary to this mysterious, intangible thing called progress. Progress must be served, even though it must be served by the destruction of the individual. Progress produces means of destroying the individual. We must accept this. We must accept the bomb. We must accept all of the vast developments of destructive armament, simply because they are evidences of pressure and progress. Today, therefore, we cannot depend upon society providing a normal environment for the person. We cannot assume that our children will go out in a world that has been planned to be the best for those children. It is not going to supply these children with the type of environment which will conserve their emotional resources, give them calmness and peace within themselves, and assure them a moderate degree of success without the terrible competitive pressure that destroys health. What society is really producing is instruments for the advancement of its own purposes. Quite aware of the fact that these implements and instruments are going to be destroyed by society, but that they are expendable, and that there will always be a new generation of young and hopeful persons to take the place of those that are destroyed by so-called social pressure. To face the situation, then, means only that the pressure problem must be solved by the person. It will not be solved by the school system. It will not be solved by science. It will not be solved by sociology. It will not be solved by industry or politics or economics. It will not be solved by raising wages or increasing insurance premiums. It will not be solved by the multiplying of social benefits. The pressure problem is the interval between what man wants to accomplish and what man can accomplish. And this interval widens every day because his mind is capable of visualizing a kind of world that his body is not capable of building, that his strength is not capable of maintaining. So the person has to take over the administration of his own life. He must decide what he can do and what he cannot do. He must decide to the degree that he wishes to commit suicide to maintain the psychic pace of his contemporaries. He must decide to what degree he wants to be sick in order to be successful. He must try to decide what his standard of living is worth to him, what he wants to have out of life, what he expects to achieve in the span of years allotted to him. And he must try to free himself from these exaggerating and distorting mental emotional processes that lure him on to a way of life that is inconsistent with every simple fact that we know to be true. If we are willing to sit down and think through our resources, then we can lay plans. We can view life as a challenge, but not as an ogre that is determined to destroy us. We can play life skillfully as a master gamester plays his game. We cannot win this chess game of life in the sense that we are going to ultimately attain victory over living. We can, however, win to the degree of having a useful, comfortable, and reasonable life while we are here. Pressures nearly always arise from unreasonable and inordinate demands on the part of the individual. His desires for things which he cannot or will not earn. And then the various disgruntlements that arise from his lack of adjustment to his own standard of demands. Putting it this way, the individual to solve pressure must become more in himself or demand less. There are two ways of satisfying need. One is to have more, the other is to need less. Diogenes was the master of this equation. Today we have the right perhaps more than at any other time in history, to make demands upon life if we are willing to meet these demands by an adequate expression of personal resolve. If we wish a certain measure of success, we have a right to strive for it. But we have no right to expect this success by bluff or subterfuge. The bluffer and the deceiver are immediately tied into terrible tension problems because they are insincere and insecure. So the person who wishes a life of rich fulfillment must plan and build according to the pattern of his own hopes, beliefs, and convictions. He must find ways to fit himself for the things that he wants to do. Years ago, I knew a young man who, by a strange fluke, was given a job, an important and critical job, in an airplane factory as a designing engineer. He had never taken a course in engineering. He had never taken a course in draftsmanship. And these were the two subjects he had to use all the time. He was a good bluffer. He was able to keep this job without anyone realizing or finding out that he did not know for nearly 10 years, simply by carefully copying the work of others, by studying a little, by asking a few judicious questions at the right moment. He was able to maintain this very difficult position, a position which paid him very well, and it demanded in him a new standard of living which he did not wish to give up. In 10 years, however, he fell apart. He could not continue the bluff any further. He was hopelessly wrecked, nervously and emotionally, and had he not stopped when he did, would probably have ended mentally very ill. He could not keep on bluffing. The responsibility, the fear, the anxiety hanging over him all the time, for he never knew from moment to moment when some question would be asked, some situation would arise in which his bluff would be discovered. So he could not stand the strain. And to most of us, this is to a measure our problem. Well, we're not bluffing as he did. We are inadequate and we know it. We are never sure when an emergency will arise which will overwhelm our reserve and our knowledge. We are never sure when we will no longer be able to continue the courses which seem essential to us at the moment. We have to get past this, or we will never get past tensions. Because tensions, with their anxieties, with their debilitating results, arise from this inner realization that we are not secure in the things that we are doing. To meet this natural problem, we know that today experts in nearly every field are going back to school every year. The graduate engineer, graduating at the top of his class, could not pass the final examination for a class 2 years later than his own. Constant change, constant modification, the pressures increasing continuously, everything becoming more complicated, and the individual merely becoming older and more tired. Youth, however, cannot take over either. Youth today, as research is showing, is graduating from college completely exhausted in terms of nervous resources. The average college graduate today is more psychically and nervously tired than the average man of three times his years in the last generation. He is already an old, worn-out person when he graduates, because too much has been demanded of him, particularly at a time of life in which his resources are not at their best for this type of pressure. The person living along through life used to believe that he could live securely in at least the probability of his own life expectancy. World conditions would not change enough in 50 or 75 years to cripple the right of the average person to survive through his span of life expectancy without impossible situations arising. Today, the whole world changes in 5 years. There are no longer securities of these probabilities. The man who masters his trade today is not certain that he will work for the rest of his natural life. He does not know when he will be replaced. He does not know when the field of endeavor with which he is concerned will become obsolete. These pressures add a constant subconscious fear which eats at the securities of this person. Yet we all live in one kind of a world. Whether we know it or not, we live in a rather pleasant world. After all, most human beings are not ferocious or terrible creatures. The tendency of nearly all normal persons of all races and nations is to be kindly, well-disposed, sincerely interested in preventing suffering and bestowing as much happiness and contentment as possible. We are not living in an awful world. We are not really living in a heartless world, because most of the people who are in trouble or are causing trouble are good-natured, kindly intentioned persons. They are all dominated by some kind of a strange, abstract pattern, and this pattern grinds all of them into the same ultimate fatigue situations. It is not that it is a nasty, terrible life that we live. It is that we have gradually set up patterns and standards and attitudes which are commonly afflicting us all and making life a desperate and difficult cycle for hundreds of millions of human beings. And out of the pressures and difficulties and stresses of these patterns come disorientations of mind and emotion. What we call really nasty people are mostly merely very tired, disorganized, disoriented people, nervously exhausted, and therefore incapable of normal, happy, well-adjusted function. The Zen situation takes this particular problem under consideration very definitely. And one way perhaps we can approach it is by reference to what is called the no mask. In Western psychology today, some schools have the term the persona, or the mask of the person which he wears before society. This mask represents the individual's defense. It is the person he wants others to see. It is the person which is the product of ambition and bluff and pressure and tension. It is the successful person who wishes his photograph to be on the cover of the local handbook of the social clubs, the service clubs organization. It is the face of the young politician rising in the world, and of the old substantial broker at the head of his corporation. It is the face of a strange, tired responsibility, which is regarded now as respectability. This mask, the no mask, is tied in very greatly with the psychology of Asia. And if you notice the various images and symbols of the deities of Hinduism and Buddhism, you will realize how often this mask appears. The no mask of Asia is the face that is inscrutably calm. The strange, quiet face, about which lingers just the suggestion of a smile. A strange, almost expressionless face. Western people, observing this expression on the face of their Eastern brethren, are inclined to assume that it is a mask, that this Oriental person is wearing this expression as having cultivated it for years in front of a mirror, that this expression is something that he puts on for a purpose, and that behind this expression is all the confusion, all the intensity, all the uncertainty of Western man. But the Eastern man has found a cute and interesting way to conceal this, and in this way, to a sense, discomfort his Western friend. Actually, this attitude is not correct. The no mask of Asia represents a cultivated internal integration. This expression represents 2,000 years or more of civilizations and cultures and ways of life that have been founded upon self-discipline, that never for a moment does the conduct of the individual escape from the pattern of that individual's conscious concept of value. In other words, this no mask has been developed through thousands of years of self-control. It is not an expression put on. It is an attitude of consciousness moving out. And the face becomes the symbol of this attitude of consciousness. Some years ago, there was an illustration, I think it was in Life magazine. A photographer had taken a picture of a crowded intersection in New York City. And in this picture, there were at least 100 clearly visible faces, sufficiently well photographed, although the persons did not know they were being photographed, so that you could study the characteristics of expression. At the time the picture was published, the caption was placed underneath it, pointing out the interesting fact that in this nearly 100 faces on the street, there was not one with a smile. 100 faces, 100 glooms of one kind or another. Every one of these faces was loaded with tension. They were all grim, locked faces, with deep furrows in the corners of the mouth, furrows that slanted downward to give a strangely grave, sad, melancholy kind of expression. Deep-set eyes, heavily shadowed by the light even upon the aquiline features of Western man. Faces loaded with pressure, loaded with grim resolve. Faces bitter, saddened, exasperated, relentless, but faces strangely and wonderfully filled with not an evil look, but a strangely sick look. I was talking with a Japanese friend in a little hotel in a small village about 100 miles north of Tokyo, and he was telling me about the visitors and tourists that come to the hotel. Not too many. Maybe one group every 3 or 4 weeks. The rest of the time he lives entirely with the native people. He says he begins to realize why it is that the little children cry when strangers appear. Western people frighten Eastern children. Not by anything they do, because like as not, they're handing out candy bars. What, however, is that as the child will say to its parent, why does this person dislike me? Why is this Western person looking at the Eastern child as though the child had done something evil? The Western person doesn't even know it. He isn't mad at the child. Perhaps in some mysterious way he's mad at himself. He doesn't know he's doing it. But the non-Western, seeing this face, sees what appears to be antagonism of some kind. He doesn't know that this is the natural expression of Western man. He does not know that the aquiline features, the deeper set eyes, the strongly modeled face, the pressured jaw, the thin line of the mouth, these are not attitudes put on to discomfort or frighten a small child. They are the face of Western man. A face that is hurt all the time. A face that is fighting for survival against something. And behind this face is impatience, irritability, inability to let down. This face is on a person who fidgets all the time, who cannot sit still, who can scarcely read a book anymore, must turn to something if it's only the bar. This face is a face of criticism, that mysteriously is always finding something wrong with other people and other things. The face which condemns by a subtle expression that has now become part of its own nature. The individual who subtly resents the tremendous pressure of other people who are opposed to what he's trying to do. Inside, he is defending himself against that man who wants his job, that other person who wants to break his home, the children who want too much for their own good. All the different desires that bleed this person have created their scars upon his character. So these foreign people, particularly the Asiatic, with very smooth, even surfaced face, has very few depths, very few clear-cut lines of features, whose face very often reaches great age without even a wrinkle. A face which is strangely bland. This contrast is extraordinary when you begin to study it. Perhaps it is all racial type, perhaps that is the way the Eastern face is. I wonder, however, if it isn't to a certain degree associated over thousands of years with the Eastern life attitude, the attitude of facing all things with quietude, without these intensities, without these pressures with which we are so commonly familiar. One thing that is obvious from Eastern psychology is that the Eastern person has never reached that attitude that we have of demanding pity. The Easterner does not want other people to know his troubles. He does not want to have people say to him, poor old man, you're standing much too much. He doesn't want this. He does not want anyone else to know his sorrows, or his pain, or his responsibility, for the simple reason that these things are his. If he has joys, he shares them. If he has problems, he keeps them to himself. If people have problems, to advertise them is only to admit weakness. So instead of the person expounding all his grievances and expecting to be thoroughly sympathized with, The Eastern individual assumes that his grievances result from his own stupidity and they are his own private business. And he hopes that he will not impose them upon other people. This is a strange point that we find in Eastern philosophy, that it is bad enough for each individual to carry his own burdens, but it is entirely too much to burden other people with our burdens. And to do so is to indicate lack of character. There is no applause for weakness. Thus, the expression of the mask, the no mask, is one in which the person keeps his own counsels, keeps his own secrets, solves his own problems within himself the best he can, and never under any conditions feels that it is proper or right for him to demand understanding from other people. His life is not best because he is understood, but because he learns himself to understand. His philosophy has been built upon this. Another interesting phase of this mask is that we notice in watching Eastern people that when the face relaxes, as in sleep, or as in conversation, or when the individual forgets himself, the face almost always relaxes into a smile. When the person is not trying to have an attitude, is simply releasing his entire nature from the pressure of controls of all kinds, the Eastern person does not fall into a sourness. He doesn't suddenly have a sad and ancient look about him. Relaxation is not negative. It does not mean that he gradually passes into a kind of stern, sad, silent expression. The natural relaxation seems to be to smile. The smile as an expression is infinitely more used in the East than it is in the West. It overcomes practically all language barriers. But no one knows what to do about anything. A big grin indicates that everyone is doing the best he can and hoping for the best. If he can't find your luggage, he smiles. He is doing his best. I told a man in Tokyo that the Tokyo Travel Bureau put me on the wrong train. He was convulsed.